Good evening. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and along with Mel, K2 KEY. We intend to hold a thing called a TechNet, in which most of the time people get their questions about electronics in general, but ham radio in particular. Most of the time they get their questions answered about things like favorite rigs and best transmission lines, modes of propagation, and so on. There's a lot to this hobby of ham radio. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and me your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So please give me your call letters, your name, and your yes and no. K2LIW.
This is KC2QIW. The name is Joe, mobile, and no.
W2JPW, Lou, yes.
W2PNJ, Bob, yes.
KC2LXD, yes. The name is Rodney. Seeing all this is K2KY.
KC2MPP, Steve, and no question.
KC2QIW, mobile, the name is Joe, and no questions at this time.
Okay, we've got Joe, Lou with a yes, Bob with a yes, Rodney. Rodney, is it KC2 Lima X-ray Delta? Do I have your call letters correct?
That's correct.
Okay, we got him, and MDH with a no, and Mel. Anyone else with a yes to check in? Please give me your call letters and name at this time.
Did you have me down for a yes, 6WS2N?
WS2N. Never heard of you. Okay, Paul, we got you down. All right, the first person with a yes was Lou, W2JPW. You got it, Lou.
Okay, Dick, good evening to you and all. Couple of quick questions. First of all, I'm kind of interested in that article in QST about the new Tentec Omni 7, I think it is. I'm interested in it from the standpoint of that it has double roofing filters in the second and third conversion. It's, in other words, two sets instead of one set that is switchable, like some of the other radios are said to have, more expensive radios in the multi-thousand-dollar class. They all end up in a DSP stage. What happens, Dick, what happens when noise arrives through these consecutive stages and hits the DSP stage? In other words, I'm looking for the best type of radio that will give me the greatest noise reduction, since I live in the noise capital of the world here. And the second question is just something of interest. I had heard you speak one night, just off the cuff. You mentioned that K1JT and yourself were talking about possibly adding voice capabilities to his software for EME work. I didn't think such a thing would be possible because of the bandwidth considerations. So anything you would care to tell us about that would be fascinating. And I'd love to have later on talk to our space expert about global warming on Mars. Back to you, Dick, W2JPW.
Okay, global warming on Mars. How about that one? Okay. The roofing filter on a modern-day multi-conversion rig is intended to, I'm trying to think of the best way of wording it, avoid the image. In most cases, the so-called roofing filter is the very first filter after the first mixer. You've got a filter in front of the mixer. Its greatest intention is to allow only the main signal to come through, not the image. If, for instance, I had a 10 megacycle IF, and I want to listen to a 1 megacycle signal, I would set the local oscillator to 11 megacycles. And so the local oscillator on the high side, mixing with the local RF signal at 1 megacycle, would create a 10 megacycle difference, and that would be the first IF. And you can see by the numbers that I've used, it's an up-conversion system. Quite often, the very first conversion, first IF, is lower in frequency. But there are rigs where the very first IF is up in frequency. For instance, the ICOM R7000 does that when you're tuning the lower frequencies. I believe the very first IF is 78 megacycles. And there's an advantage in doing that. It allows you to avoid the image. In the example I gave you, the first image would be way up at a much higher frequency, and the RF filter would have an easy job of filtering that out. So let's jump down now to the DSP itself. The very last stage of processing of the system is where DSP is usually applied to the so-called audio output, you could say, although there are DSP systems which do the work on the first IF, last IF frequency. In any of those cases, the digital signal processing is looking for a particular kind of cyclicity to the signal. The desired signal, at least as far as what it presents as data to the IF strip is concerned, is a reasonably cyclic signal. If your very fast last IF is 455 kz, that DSP filter, if one is located there, is looking for a repetitive 455 kz component, which has either amplitude or phase modulation on it, angular or amplitude modulation, so to speak. Noise does not have that cyclicity. So depending on the kind of digital signal processing, and there's lots of different kinds, noise without that cyclicity does not create the same response. I know that's not comforting. I know you're looking for more than that. You would like to believe that a smart circuit could differentiate between real signal and real noise. And this is not my area of strongest suit, as you can tell. We're getting now into a more computer-oriented chunk of electronics. And those who have tuned to the TechNet over the years know that I'm a bit light on computers. I consider myself an RF maven. I'm not a computer maven. Thank goodness my son, Christopher, has specialized in computers, has his degrees in that subject, and he spends a lot of time studying all the possible ways that non-Microsoft techniques can do computer processing. I don't have a good answer, as you can tell. I'm going to get the beginning of an answer on this one, Lou. When it comes to voice off the moon, I know of various techniques that will enhance a voice signal off the moon. And that represents a serious problem because the moon is not a flat reflector. I don't have to tell you guys that it's got a strong curvature to it. To an earthbound observer, it is highly convex. In other words, it's the center of the moon is much closer to you than the perimeter of the moon. Therefore, the signal you send out from your backyard antenna is a circular, is a signal going out with a spherical wavefront to it. The actual phase front to it is spherical. But by the time it goes a quarter of a million miles and gets to the moon, it ends up as an extremely flat signal. The radius of curvature is actually a quarter of a million miles, and to any reasonable reflecting surface, that is a planar wave. The moon itself is highly curved, so therefore the portion of the moon, the submarine portion, the closest portion of the moon in the center from your point of view, gives you an echo much sooner than the portions at the perimeter. So the moon echo is smeared in the time domain, and that represents a serious problem to signals that have any significant bandwidth to them. Slow speed Morse code can go through there quite nicely. voice has much higher frequency components, and it's going to be smeared in the time domain, and that's going to create a definite problem in what the voice sounds like. I have listened to NASA's signal from Goldstone, California, bounced off the moon, and the echo received by my FM receiving system, which at the time was located in Farmingdale, Long Island. And the voice portions were intelligible, but highly distorted. The nice thing about an FM or a phase modulated system, angular modulated system, is that it's preceded, the last stage of detection is preceded by a limiter, so only the strongest portion gets through, everything else gets to some degree chopped off by the limiter. That would suggest that if you've got a knob signal, and they were using something like a 10,000 watt transmitter into a 260 foot diameter dish, they certainly had a lot of effective isotropic radiated power, EIRP. So more than enough signal strength came back to me, and therefore using a limiter on such a signal is the right thing to do. And when you have a ham radio signal, which is going to start off with much weaker transmitter, much smaller antenna, you don't have that luxury of throwing away some of that signal by way of a limiter. A limiter that is not given a signal that's strong enough is a disadvantage. Whenever you study the signal-to-noise ratio output versus carrier-to-noise ratio input of an angular modulated detection system, you find the right curves in the right books on this particular subject, and you'll realize that FM signal demodulation has a very strong so-called crashing characteristic. In other words, as you make the signal weaker and weaker going into the final processing stage of that receiver, at first the audio signal-to-noise ratio output decreases in a predictable manner. And pretty soon as you get near threshold, the audio signal-to-noise ratio decreases at a much, much faster rate. And they call it the crashing effect. Part of what's going on there is that a limiter on a very weak signal will, believe it or not, suppress the signal by comparison to the noise. Not easy to explain why that takes place, but it suffice to say that across the bandwidth of the final IF stage, there is more specific power in the noise than there is in the signal you're looking for, and that therefore the limiter, which is looking for the strongest signal, is going to be captured by the strongest signal, which in that case is noise, and suppress the desired signal. So when your signal-to-noise ratio is low, you don't want to use a limiter. I know this helps a little bit, but not much. I don't remember having a specific conversation with Joe Taylor, K1JT. I've attended a number of places where he gave a brief lecture about his system, and I'm now having trouble remembering him having a specific conversation on voice with EME. He has a specific system which is being used on EME for Morse code, or let's call it encoded signals. The majority of the Joe Taylor techniques are techniques which transmit a series of four tones in various combinations. And the various combinations of the tones being present or not being present represent the letters of the alphabet and the numerals from 0 to 9. So that system is capable of detecting extremely weak signals. 28 dB of negative signal-to-noise ratio can be detected with that system, where the human ear will say nothing is there. A spectran display will just barely show you that something is there. And under those conditions, when everything's working correctly, the Joe Taylor modulation-demodulation technique can give you extremely high accuracy of copy of that signal. Let's see if Mel has anything to add to this one. I know that I haven't really answered your question on this one, Lou, as you can tell. And I think you've almost stumped us tonight. Maybe you're going to be getting one of these awards. But maybe Mel's going to come through on this one. And I'm going to also give a little bit of a delay in case we have some digital signal processing informed people that can add to what little I just said. K2KEY, Mel, have you guys used much DSP in the receivers you own? K2RIW on the TechNet?
Roger. This is K2KEY, yes. Okay, let's take this step by step. Let's try to break it down slowly. And hold on, let me just... let me just turn the pot down. Yeah, I'm cooking tonight. Hold on. Okay, that's better. Before I have a boil over here. As far as roofing filters, let's discuss first to begin with roofing filters. As you know, I've done quite a bit of work with BPF band filters, 8-hole filters and all, and also very interested, always been in low signal reception. As far as the roofing, first, let's understand what a roofing filter is. Basically, a roofing filter is an analog device. And it will determine the attenuation. In other words, the roofing filter, being an analog device, it will determine, let me see if I can get this in the right words, will determine the attenuation of the offset of the sensor equal to twice the IM. So simply put, the roofing filter is doing two things. It's looking for bursts of noise. At the same time, it's looking for it in an analog mode. It's not a digital device, a roofing filter. And being that it is at the, usually at the, it's designed to be from the center of the IF frequency to usually twice the IF. In other words, it'll look at the harmonic of the IF. Did I say that clear enough, Dick, before I go any further over?
I think you did, and it's not an easy one to explain. I don't think I can make an improvement on this one, though. So we'll go ahead.
Okay, Roger. All right, now, if we go ahead... And we go ahead and we go to, like you say, the next situation. If we go, as you say, we're up converting, and if we were up converting, and let's say the IF, we go from one IF through the mixer, and let's say our first mixer somewhere, well, let's go backwards a little bit. If we want to do the ultimate, before we even get involved with a roofing filter, we will start out at the pre-selector. Now, you know, it's a very funny situation, you understand, with any kind of receiving equipment, and that is the inherent noise that's generated either by the electronics itself, or what is passed through. In many cases, it's very hard to really, once it gets into the receiver, to get past the first stages, it's very hard then to do much with it. So what we will do at the pre-selector, what is the thinking now? See, we're really going to break down a receiver step by step. We're not going to jump. DSP is a little bit further on, so I'm going to start really at the beginning. At the pre-selector, we could put in a what we call BPF, a bandpass filter. The bandpass filter usually is 6-8 pole filter. And the idea is, let's try to stop as much noise. Now, you see, random noise is a problem that we're not going to, if it's a burst here and there, like, a static discharge from some lightning somewhere out there, it's pretty hard to do much with that. But we can, knock down a lot of this stuff that we say, well, we'll try to do stuff with atmospheric voices that are commonly, repetitive. So, again, we'll start out the pre-selector. We'll put in, we'll use a bandpass filter there called the BPF. And we'll try to, in other words, stop as much noise by simple analog means right at the beginning. Hope I put that in the right words, Dick. Do you want to answer that? Over.
I'm going to give a couple words about noise and noise. If your receiver was ideal, It is only amplifying that which comes down your transmission line from that antenna. That's a perfect receiver. It would have so-called 0 decibels of noise figure. And some modern-day transistors come awfully close to doing that. And if that's true, all of the noise that you're talking about is coming from the atmosphere. That which the antenna is looking into. Realistically, some of the noise is created by your own electronics. There is almost no discriminant between the two. But if the noise is coming from your antenna, or the noise is coming from the early stages of your RF amplification of your receiver, because it's not perfectly ideal, if you had to devise laboratory equipment that could differentiate between your own electronic noise and atmospheric noise, that would be extremely difficult. Noise is noise, but they do get added together. The nice thing about noise from those two different sources is they're incoherent with each other. In other words, there's essentially no relationship on an instantaneous basis between the noise your electronics make and the noise coming from the atmosphere. They're unrelated. As such, they add in a power relationship. If you add 1 milliwatt of noise from your electronics and 1 milliwatt of noise from your antenna, just to make a crazy example, they would add together to be 2 milliwatts. If the noise from your electronics and the noise from the antenna was correlated, somehow related, they would not add in a power relationship, they would add in a voltage relationship. Instead of getting twice the power output of noise, you'd be getting a 4 times the power output noise, twice voltage. Thank goodness these noises are unrelated, uncorrelated, and they add power relationship, not a voltage relationship. So, regardless of where the noise is coming from, your final stage of detection in front of your earphones is not going to be able to differentiate between the two. You're going to try to lower each one of them as much as possible. Electronically, you choose low noise transistors. And now you've got a conflict of interest. We're getting now into the trade-off between dynamic range and noise figure. If I had an ideal transistor with very low noise generated in that transistor, because it is an amplifier in front of the rest of the receiver, and in almost all cases, the rest of the receiver, for various reasons, makes noise. If I could put a whole lot of gain in front of that receiver, my desirable signal is made stronger than that undesirable noise created downrange in the receiver chain, and now I overpower it. That's the good news. The bad news is that as you add gain of your low noise amplifier, you are lowering the dynamic range of the receiver. That's a fancy way of saying if the guy down the block gives you a strong signal, you're going to get some kind of an overload distortion. Usually third order intermodulation distortion, but not necessarily. There's lots of ways you can do it. Therefore, you'll notice that many of the modern day receivers have a button on the front panel where you can turn the preamplifier on and off. If the preamplifier is doing some good, you would think to yourself, why in the world would I ever turn it off? Leave it on all the time. Operate during a contest like a field day operation or a June or a September contest or a January contest, and maybe you're located only a mile away from a bunch of other guys with kilowatts, you'll soon realize how much trouble you can get in when the preamplifier is in operation. Strong local signal will create saturation of that preamplifier or the stages of the receiver downrange, and so under strong local signal on adjacent frequencies, under those conditions, being able to press that button to bypass the preamplifier can make a huge improvement. Because Japan is a country with a high density of ham radio operators located very close to each other, you'll notice that almost all of the so-called bright boxes we can buy are gain-starved. They don't have enough preamplification in front of the first stage of the receiver to give ultimate sensitivity. Therefore, when you go out and buy your advanced receiver research low noise amplifier and you put it in front, you added a 20 dB gain amplifier and you make it 11 decibels of improvement in receiver sensitivity. You could say that under those conditions, it appears as though your receiver that you purchased was 20 decibels shy on RF amplification. But you better have a bypass switch, as I mentioned before. This is a little bit more of a story. I know we're, again, a little bit off of Lou's original question, but maybe this helps a little. Back to you, Mel, because I don't think you had a chance to finish your thought. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. I'd like to say it is a complicated subject, and I've done my research into it, did my homework to a great extent on the subject when I built that, you know, receiver, my super receiver. But a lot of, not only, work financially, but also started, running into money. You remember all the different things I got involved with. But basically, before we go any further, we must understand, as just Dick said, that we were talking about, the BPF, the bandpass filter, and your pre-selector, is actually there to really filter as much as possible, really eliminate mixing of that noise into your local oscillator. In other words, that noise that will come through the front end there, the BPF, will immediately begin, if it gets by there, or whatever does get by there, there will be some signal get by there. And the BPF, in the most cases, is basically built around a low-pass filter design. Now, we're still not into digital. We've got a bit to go before we get to digital. As I said, we've got to take this really step-by-step to understand what we're looking for in the design of a top-notch receiver. So we're putting this through a low-pass filter called a bandpass, BPF. And the idea now is to eliminate, leakage. I guess that's the best word. I don't know if it is the right word, but leakage into the first mixing as much as possible. Dick, do you want to go a little further with this before I go on? Over.
Yeah, I think I do. And when Mel is talking about leakage, he really is talking about adjacent frequency signals getting through. That's one kind of leakage. Or image signals from the super heterodyne process. That's another kind of leakage. One of the advantages a digital signal processor can do for you is that it can synthesize a large number of simultaneous poles. If money was no object and volume and weight is no object, in theory you could build a filter that doesn't have three poles, but has 30 poles to it. Poles meaning the number of individual tuned LC networks in the filter. And if you properly synthesize a 30-pole filter, and I've worked on one, I've worked on a very expensive 30-pole filter, with proper design, it can have what's called brick wall response. In other words, the left-hand skirt, when the receiver, if you're plotting a graph of performance of the filter, which is vertical on the graph, versus frequency, which is horizontal on the graph, and you start slowly sweeping up the frequency, and you start hitting the beginning of the passband of the filter, and studying that left-hand side rising very slowly, it would rise extremely rapidly, almost like a square wave on an oscilloscope screen. Across the bandpass of the filter, the response would be extremely flat, both in amplitude and in group delay distortion. So there we got to explain that one. But it's suffice to say that across the flat top bandpass region of the filter, you're expecting extremely high time domain linearity as well as linear amplitude performance passing that signal. Difficult combination. And then when you get to the right-hand side of the filter, you want it to drop off again very, very rapidly. That so-called brick wall filter cannot be created within the laws of physics without using a large number of either real LC networks, each one called a pole, like a 30-pole filter, and within reasonable volume and cost and whatever, you usually can't do that. However, with a smart enough computer program and the right kind of a digital signal processing program that is synthesizing that filter, you can synthesize a large number of poles with a sophisticated program with a very small physical size of a circuit that's doing the the analog-to-digital conversion, the filter function in digital, and then converting it back to a digital-to-analog signal so that the rest of the receiver can use it. So that's the main thing DSP can do for you. Synthesize various kinds of rather exotic filters in a small package, and the filter itself is programmable. There are times when you want a broad filter, times when you want a narrow filter, times you want a filter that emphasizes the linearity as far as group delay distortion, and so on. So depending on what you're doing with the receiver, that digital signal processing filter could be adaptable. You may want to tune the filter one way when you're doing moonbound, another way when you're doing a meteor scatter, another way when you're doing ordinary amplitude modulation of one of these AM guys on the high end of 80 meters. So that's another thing that DSP can do for you. I don't think very many of the receivers that we bought today have that adaptability yet. I think the day will come when we discriminating amateurs will be demanding that, and the customers and the vendors that they're smarting up will create that hardware for us, because that's what we want to buy. We're going to be voting with our pocketbook. Lou, I know there's a lot more to this subject. I know we really didn't answer your question. I feel a little bit inadequate on this one. I know we've got other people waiting. And if you're willing to wait, we're going to go to those other people and then come back to this, because I think we've only just barely scratched the surface. To a small degree, Lou, I think you've stumped us, and maybe you're going to get the prize for the night. W2JPW. Be careful with the questions, Lou. K2RIW on the tech net.
Okay, Dick. Well, thank you very much. Yeah, it's a difficult subject. My observation here has been that, to make it very simple, the receivers with the greatest dynamic range are better at helping to bring signals through the noise than ones that are not so good. And so I'm really looking for the best radio for the money that will give me the best performance in a very, very noisy environment. And as far as noise-canceling phasing devices are concerned, they do help. But what do you do when you have three or four different ones on at once from different and coming in from different directions? You phase one out, you don't get them all. Unless they all combine and are coming in more or less from the same source. And I've been talking about HF problems. This has nothing to do with receiver noise figures or internally generated noise. Because the noises I'm talking about are so many decibels above any internal receiver noise that it's hardly worth mentioning. It's an HF problem, primarily HF plus 6. 6 being the noisiest VHF band you can imagine here. Excuse me. So back to you, Dick, and I'll listen out and be here for the entire net. So thank you, and back to you.
Yeah, Eric is also recognized. I'm going to turn it over to you, to Eric, in a second to add his words on this. He's worked with more of these circuits than I have. Don't give up, Lou, when you have multiple undesired signals. We got to be careful about the word noise here. Noise is a very relative word. Noise to one person is signal to another, particularly when it comes to digital type signal. The so-called co-channel interference antenna technique, in which you're able to steer a null of your antenna system in the direction of an undesired QR Mary, QR Nancy. To reject one signal in one direction, you read the right book, that's easy. Don't give up if you've got two or three or four signals in two, three, or four directions. If you add more hardware to that system, other antennas in that cancellation network, there's nothing stopping you from creating multiple nulls in multiple directions simultaneously. I didn't say it's easy, but the laws of physics will let you do that. When you really get into what's called the Widrow algorithm, W-I-D-R-O-W, this guy way back in the late 60s came up with a phased array antenna technique. You could say a phased array antenna is the antenna equivalent of digital signal processing. I could make those words. I could almost make that story stick. So with the Widrow algorithm, a kind of phased array antenna DSP, you can steer as many nodes in three-dimensional space as the number of elements in your antenna minus one. If I built a phased array antenna with five individual elements being combined, in theory I can create four simultaneous nulls in space, four simultaneous peaks in space, all at once. And I can make the peaks fall on the desirable signals, make the nulls fall on the undesirable signals, and that, with your algorithm, gives you a mathematical process. We're getting pretty deep on this one. Not many guys are going to want to dig that far into it. But when it comes to military hardware, this has been done successfully. I've seen it in operation, and I've become a believer. And I'm sitting here dreaming that the day will come when I will have the resources to do that in my backyard. Eric, anything you can add to all this will help. We're floundering. KE2EJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, K2RIW, KE2EJ. A couple things I just wanted to point out is that you're talking about noise reduction and DSP. There's two different forms of DSP that the receiver manufacturers deal with today. One is DSP that operates in audio, and the other is IFDSP. IFDSP is a lot harder to do because of the hardware required. We need to raise the sample rate to some reasonable rate that fits within the test end of an IF strip. All the rules of what makes a good radio still apply with DSP, but getting specifically down to noise reduction, most of the stuff that's out there is actually audio DSP. There's something called an LMS, or a least mean square algorithm, which is something that uses a series of filters, and it's very recursive. It actually tries to identify what's noise and what's not, and it inverts the noise and makes it go away. You did say that DSP is a complicated program, and actually a 30-fold pole filter in DSP using something called an IIR, or an infinite impulse response filter. Each pole is just simply a recursive calculation. It's a coefficient or a particular value. You have to really get into calculus if you want to understand the way it goes together. But the actual DSP programming, if you're using something called a Harvard architecture computer, which is different than the traditional microprocessor that you use in the PC, it not only runs faster, but it also actually does fetches from memory from three discreetly different and independent chunks of memory simultaneously. The basic thing that performs the algorithms in most of your DSP work is something called a MAC, or a multiply and accumulate. Basically, it does a multiply and it adds. And as you look into calculus, really a mathematical way of describing a shape. And you can come up with different coefficients, and I really won't get into how it works because that'll take an hour or two. You can make filters that are very narrow or very broad, brick wall, all sorts of really interesting things that you can do. And if you're fortunate enough to have something that goes fast enough to do IFDSP, you can also use the DSP to do your demodulation and turn things into audio. Back to you, Dick.
Thank you,
White.
Okay, Mel recognized, and Eric, I thank you for that further explanation. But as Eric was talking, and as I'm thinking of Lou's original question, something else suddenly arrived in my mind, and that is, I've worked on DSP-like systems in a military hardware environment, and I can tell you that the number of bits of analog to digital conversion on the very first stage of the DSP can at times be extremely important. In other words, I could start off with an inexpensive analog to digital converter that does its converting with 8 bits of resolution. If I'm willing to spend some more money, I can get more than 10 bits, 12 bits, 14 bits, maybe even 16 bits. So you're getting higher and higher fidelity, higher and higher resolution of the first step of converting that signal from the analog domain into digital domain. The more bits, in theory, the higher the dynamic range and the higher the fidelity capability. That's the good news. The bad news is that when you're using a 14-bit analog to digital converter instead of an 8-bit analog converter, 8-bit digital analog converter, you're now creating a tremendous increase in the amount of digital data that that first stage is creating. You could rapidly get to the point where you're choking the hog. The data you're coming out with is extremely high quality, but now the requirement for the microprocessor to use all of that data becomes a cost-effective problem. It becomes a power dissipation problem. You look inside of a modern-day personal computer that's running at a 2 gigahertz clock rate, and the first thing that'll strike you is, wow, look at the heat sink on that mother. I'm talking about the actual motherboard. There's multiple things I'm saying here. Be careful, fellas. The actual microprocessor on the motherboard has got this great, big, ugly-looking, or depending on your point of view, beautiful-looking thing that's trying to drain the heat out of that microprocessor. He's got a zillion transistors in there. They're flying as fast as the hammers of hell, as they would say, creating heat like no tomorrow. And if you don't drain that heat out of there real fast, the chip will have a meltdown. Or if it's got the right kind of built-in protection circuitry, it'll sense the fact that it's in an overheat mode and it'll turn itself off until it cools off again. So you can see that there's another set of problems here. And to get really high dynamic range, signal-to-noise ratio discrimination, the most severe environment of that I know of is a global positioning satellite receiver system. That signal coming down from your global positioning satellite starts off in the front end of your receiver, 26 decibels or 24 decibels below the noise of that near state-of-the-art electronics in the front end. And the back-end processing of that system, which is a kind of very elaborate digital signal processing, manages to suck that signal out of the noise because it has a very specific signature to it. It's got a pseudo-random noise-like characteristic. In other words, it's got a very predictable kind of digitally created noise, which has a specific signature to it. It's got a so-called gold code, and there's a lot of chips of information per individual bit of information. You've got a huge compression ratio or expansion ratio or direct sequence signal spreading going on here. The receiver generates a local pseudo-random signal exactly like the one that you anticipate coming from your particular satellite, and the signal of the locally generated one and the real one are in the digital mode being compared in a way that's looking for the correlation, sliding one versus the other in time until they line up. And when they line up, you get the 35 or so decibels of signal-to-noise ratio improvement because of that process. If you want to have a grand old time, Lou, and you do study the way a global positioning satellite receiver system works, I'll warn you, this is heavy stuff. You understand that, and you will immediately go to the head of the class of people who have got a skill, an art, which you can sell. You go to the right potential employer, and that skill, that art, is a very valuable thing to know, in my opinion. Mel, I know you wanted to add another comment to this, and we should be moving on because we've kept a couple of people waiting, because Lou has almost stumped us here. Stumped us here with a tough one. K2KEY, go ahead with your comments, Mel.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Like I say, I've looked into quite a bit of this. I want to see exactly what the newer receiver designers are doing. Now, as Dick just said, with the bandpass filter, that they have designed one with many stages, and I experimented. The one I built was only 8 branch elliptic low pass filter. It is a problem. It's an expensive problem. It's got to be put into a very good insulated case from one stage to another. It's mechanically, it's a problem.